Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. How are you, Tim?
Doing good.
Good. Halfway through the week here, sir.
Yes, we are.
Meridian Hump Day. And tomorrow, Tim, Nicholas Wood is going to join us. He is the storyteller, the historian, researcher, and investigator at the Sorrel Weed House of Savannah, Georgia. And we're going to hear some of the more compelling and weird stories, some of the rich history of the Sorrel Weed House, and some of the more frightening encounters they've had there.
Mm.
You like that?
Yeah.
Friday, Butch Witkowski is back. He'll be talking to us about UFOs, monsters, and strange anomalies, plus a brand new theater of the mind. And I have it on good authority.
Yeah.
It is a Lover's Lane Dogman tale, Tim.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Dogman got involved with the lovers?
Well, you know.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So we'll find out about that on Friday. Speaking of Friday, that begins Wizard World Minneapolis here in the Twin Cities. I'm very excited to be a part of this. I'll be out there doing talks on Friday and Saturday, and I'll be monkeying around Sunday, Tim.
I see, see what you did there. Yeah.
See what I did?
Yeah,
Peter Tork and Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees are going to be at Wizard World, and I'll get to host their panel. There's going to be a great assortment of different guests from Buffy the Vampire Slayer to Charlie Sheen to Doctor Who, Peter Capaldi, and Jenna Coleman from the TV series Doctor Who. There are Marina Sirtis from Star Trek The Next Generation is going to be on hand. Nichelle Nichols from Star Trek The Original Generation. And I think Lou Ferrigno is going to be there. I believe so. And James Marsters. I can't remember how to say his name. But
Spike.
Spike from Buffy the Vampire Slayer is going to be there.
Yep.
And Angel, I believe he showed up on that show, too.
Yeah.
So a lot of cool characters will be on hand, and it's an amazing weekend. Lots of fun. Come on out. Watch just the people in costumes. It's so fascinating to watch. The people watching there is great. But then there are panels and discussions on every aspect of nerdery, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
Science fiction, horror, comic books. You mentioned it's going to be going on. So you can find more information at Wizard World Minneapolis. Just Google it and get your tickets. Come on out and have a weekend of fun with me. And Tim will be there Friday night with me for a little bit as well. And then I'll be there Saturday and Sunday doing talks. So find it. And you can check on our website, darknessradio.com or darknessevents.com to find out more about that as well. So that's what's going on tap this week, Tim. Pretty exciting stuff. And we want to welcome our advertisers, our sponsors for the evening. We've got True Car, Tim. When you are ready to make your purchase of a new or previously owned vehicle, trust True Car. They've got over 16,000 certified True Car dealers across the United States that are going to take all of the anxiety out of buying a car away for you. They're going to make it the easiest transition you've ever done when purchasing a car. So check out True Car when you're ready to make your next purchase. And Audible. Tim, we've been talking about Audible.
Oh,
this is an amazing part of Amazon, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you love to listen to podcasts. You love listening to radio shows, things like that. Your music, Audible by Amazon, is awesome. And we've got something really cool going on with Audible. First of all, I wanted to mention, you know, I've been talking to you about all the cool stuff I've been listening to, right?
Yep.
Bruce Springsteen's biography,
yep.
which was great on Audible, and I could take it with, I don't have to carry around CDs with me. I don't have to carry around a record player.
I don't have to carry around books.
I think he put it out on vinyl as well.
Really?
Yeah, I believe so.
Really?
Here's the cool thing. You can just take it with you on any kind of MP3 player, your smartphone, your tablets, or just a standard MP3 player.
Okay.
Take it with you. I listen to the Star Wars books. They've got Doctor Who Audible books, Tim.
Really?
As a matter of fact, you can get entire collections of Doctor Who Audible books to take with you.
Oh, wow.
And for those of you horror fans, there's Dean Koontz. Uh-huh. There's Stephen King. You might be familiar with those two up-and-comers.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've been writing, and they've got some books that you can take with you as well. So today's podcast is being brought to you by Audible. Get a free Audible audio download and a free 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/darkness. They have over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Tonight's topic, Tim, I've been waiting a long time to talk about this again. I think it's been about 6 or 7 years since we've even discussed this on the show. One of the weird aspects of our world, and I don't know if this really fits into the paranormal paradigm, other than the fact that it's above the normal. It's a strange phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
Spontaneous human combustion. Now, I don't know about you, but this has fascinated me. I've seen it on shows and documentaries.
Mm-hmm.
It's terrifying because, A, it mixes two things I hate, death and fire.
Yeah.
And you put them together and you're the only thing burning.
Right.
And it's for no apparent reason.
Correct.
Yeah, that's where it starts getting wonky. Larry Arnold is joining us. He's here today to talk to us. He's redirected a background in engineering to explore the unconventional. And Larry has trained in the methodology of science with an undergraduate major in mechanical engineering. He later worked for the private sector in electrical engineering. And in 1976, he founded Parascience International. As director of PSI, he combines his scientific background with investigating and describing the intriguing world of Fortania, those unconventional subjects and weird events that fail to find acceptance, let alone explanation, within the boundaries of today's science. He wrote a book, Tim, Ablaze, The Mysterious Fires of Spontaneous Human Combustion. He's here to talk to us about this. Larry Arnold, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's our delight and pleasure. Greetings to you, Dave, and to Tim.
This is a very bizarre topic. I mean, does this fit into the world of the paranormal or supernatural, do you believe? Or is this just a natural occurrence, but like certain forms of cancer or disease, it's just very rare in certain people?
Well, it certainly is a very rare phenomenon. And yes, it does fit into the paranormal, into the bizarre. It is, as you indicate, a horrific, macabre, sensational, and highly ridiculed topic, and consequently for those of us few people who believe in it, we're considered world-class fools by mainstream science.
Well, what drew you to investigating this then, knowing that it would be a possible point of mockery?
Well, when we were first introduced to the concept of spontaneous human combustion, we were in 7th or 8th grade. We picked up a book by Frank Edwards, a newspaper journalist. And in that book, Stranger Than Science, he had a chapter about the Cinder Woman, a.k.a. Mary Hardy Reaser. And she ostensibly, according to Mr. Edwards, had combusted spontaneously, been burned to a pile of basically powder, in an apartment building in St. Petersburg, Florida, in July 2 of 1951. And reading this very macabre story always stuck with us. And when we went through, you know, additional years of schooling and scientific training, our teachers and professors, when we would ask them, had never heard of the subject. By that time, we were becoming curious about all kinds of apparent strange phenomena, the kinds of stuff that your show focuses on repeatedly. Mm-hmm. But nobody seemed to be looking into this thing that we'd read about in junior high school called spontaneous human combustion. So we decided we'd go down to the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. to see if we could find some original source material that would relate to the case of Mary Hardy Reaser. Or was this journalist merely, you know, making up a fantastic story to fill a couple pages of his book? What we discovered was that in 1951, this was front page news in St. Petersburg, Tampa, Florida. This is a real bona fide natural mystery at the time, and the experts were bumfuddled by it. How could this woman, who on the evening of July 1st, 1951, was alive, apparently in decent health, weighed about 175 pounds, the following morning was found reduced to a pile of rubble, 1 foot, a few pieces of calcined vertebrae, and a head that was said to have shrunk to the size of a teacup or orange, and a fire scene that otherwise did not exhibit any of the anticipated high heat, temperature, or fire damage that one would have expected to find.
You said her head shrunk?
That's what the reports, contemporary reports, state, yes.
Now, is that a possibility in cases of extreme heat and fire deaths? Do heads really shrink, or is that something completely out of the normal?
From all that we know in our fields of studying fire science, attending advanced arson fire training courses, shrunken heads do not occur normally. In a high heat fire that you would find in a whole structure fire, or when the cadaver of a dead person is put in a crematorium retort and exposed to temperatures in excess of 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, the skull will explode. It will fracture. The moisture content of the brain and in the cranium will expand and cause the sutures of the cranium to rupture. Skulls don't shrink, so far as we know, except in these incredibly rare cases of what history has called spontaneous human combustion.
All right, so you've uncovered this case, and there are so many strange hallmarks surrounding it. What was the explanation at the time?
Initially, there was no explanation. A lot of factors were considered. A lot of avenues were explored. It was considered that, well, Mrs. Reeser was known to be a smoker, so she clearly dropped a cigarette on her lap. Well, those who were first investigating the case, fire officials, knew what happens in a normal fire scene when there is a so-called smoking mishap. These unfortunately occur a few thousand times a year around the world, and bodies don't burn to powder. They are picked up largely intact, recognizable clearly as a male or female human being, can be taken to a morgue, taken to a medical facility and autopsied to find signs of death. Was there foul play involved? Was this indeed simply a smoking mishap? In the Reeser case, there was not enough material left in her body really to autopsy. As we said, 1 foot, a few pieces of calcite vertebrae. There was an expert in fire forensics at the time who was vacationing in St. Petersburg. His name is Dr. Wilton Marion Krogman. He had made a career study of the effects of fire on human cadavers, and he took a professional interest in the Reeser case once he heard the strange details of that fire scene. And he was bumfuddled for a number of reasons. One thing that perplexed him immediately was the extent of the reduction of her body, as we said earlier, from 175 pounds to about 8 pounds of rubble, and that included the chair in which she was last known to be seated. He was also perplexed by the apparent tremendous heat in a localized fire scene. He had conducted experiments he wrote about and, in fact, told us face-to-face, in which he had placed cadavers in retorts and exposed them to temperatures as high as 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit for 12 hours. He said only at that elevated temperature for that prolonged period of time could he incinerate a human body to the extent that was found in Mrs. Reese's apartment. And yet, above the chair in which she was last known to be seated, there was no flame damage to the ceiling above. There was minimal heat or flame damage to any other objects in the room beyond a 3-foot radius around the body and the chair in which she was last known to be seated. There's a time element that perplexed Dr. Krogman. As we said in his experiments, he insisted that he needed 12 hours uninterrupted to incinerate a body to that extent to actually calcine bone to powder. And yet in the Reeser case, she had no more than 11 hours maximum from the time that she was known to be alive until she was discovered the morning of July 2nd, probably no more than 3 or 3.5 hours. There was the absence of noxious odor of burned flesh in Mrs. Reeser's apartment that further perplexed Dr. Krogman. In fact, there was a sweet odor detected by the first responders. One of the bigger fronts of Dr. Krogman's experience was, as we said earlier, that shrunken skull that reduced to the size that reports at the time described as the size of a baseball, grapefruit, orange, teacup. And there's the simple affront to common sense and logic that just baffled Dr. Krogman. He ended up calling her the Cinder Woman. He said the Cinder Woman could not happen, but he had to admit that it did. So this raised many problems for him, and it raises problems for fire forensics professionals who have followed Dr. Krogman in his esteemed footsteps. Arguing against spontaneous human combustion, the argument that we hear most often is that if spontaneous human combustion actually occurred, you'd find internal organs not present. Dr. Benecki, a forensics biologist with international reputation, for example, says that in forensic practice, there are no known cases in which internal organs of a burned corpse were damaged more severely than the outer parts. This practical observation, he insists, is further proof that combustion never starts from inside a human body. Therefore, spontaneous human combustion doesn't occur because internal organs will always be fixed because the source of the fire that incinerates the victim is external in origin. The body burns from the outside in. Internal parts of the body are very difficult to burn by fire. Human beings are naturally impervious to fire. Very difficult to burn a cadaver. That's why crematorium operators spend a lot of money and a lot of fuel to incinerate a body over several hours in a retort. The problem is with Dr. Benecki's argument and all those who would concur with him is that Mrs. Weiser did not leave behind internal organs. So by definition, by his argument, Mrs. Weiser had to have suffered and succumbed to spontaneous human combustion as a concept.
All right. With the remains that were there, I'm sure they had to be tested, or was that not part of forensic testing at the time to see if there was an accelerant at all?
Yeah, sadly, in large part, there was no serious testing done that we've been able to uncover. Certainly, an accelerant was looked for. To our knowledge, there was no evidence of an accelerant, no gasoline, kerosene, other kind of fire-enhancing fuel discovered at the fire scene. Remains were ostensibly sent to the FBI laboratory in Washington, D.C. We've been in contact with them during our years and the decades of researching this phenomenon. What we got out of the FBI was a report that was not very helpful and indeed had some content that, to the best of our knowledge, did not even apply to the Weiser case. Researchers at the time were so desperate to come up with an explanation for Mrs. Weiser that they actually posited that Mrs. Weiser was indeed the victim of foul play. Some criminal had broken into her apartment overnight, killed the woman, and then to cover up the scene of the crime had absconded with the body, burned it off premises, and then brought the ashes from that off-site incineration back into the apartment, salted the scene, and then closed the door and fled. Logically, that makes no sense to us whatsoever. Why would a criminal even begin to do that?
Right.
Secondly, how could he have done that, right?
And how could he dump the ashes without leaving any kind of residual effect?
Precisely.
Like powder on his own shoes, a trail leaving out, because that fine powder from it would have followed him as well, or her.
One certainly would have thought that very thing indeed. But that's how desperate the officials were back in 1951 to try to come up with an explanation for what they discovered in the apartment building in which Mrs. Weiser lived. After about a month, it was determined that after, tests on furniture were ruled out as the cause of the incineration, accelerants were ruled out, foul play was basically ruled out, they fell back on the drop cigarette theory, even though, initially they could find no explanation to support that. And indeed, that flew in the face of everything that Dr. Krogman had researched up to that time and, in fact, had told us. One should expect to find that at a human fatality fire scene. So it's easy to, in hindsight, say, oh, yeah, she dropped a cigarette on her lap because, A, she was a known smoker, and, B, people drop cigarettes on themselves and asphyxiate all the time. Sadly as that is, if it were so easy to combust a human being by fire, then we have to ask, why do crematorium operators, being the businessmen that they are, spend $100,000 on a retort, a cremulator to grind up bone fragments that come out of the retort, buy 40 or 50 gallons of diesel fuel oil or a few million cubic feet of natural gas to incinerate a body, when for the cost of a cigarette, which back then would have been 10 cents, now it's a quarter, they could drop a lit cigarette on the cadaver, walk away, have a leisurely lunch, and come back and scrape up a pile of fine powder and put it in an urn and give it to the next of kin. Crematorium operators can't do that. And there's a reason they can't do that, because technology doesn't yet afford them the opportunity to do that in a retort.
Now, is there, and I'm sorry if I label the ingredient, but is it linseed oil that is known to combust on rags after it's been rubbed in?
Absolutely. Yep.
Right. So is there any chance
combustion fires will start that way?
Right. So I was curious. I mean, could it have been that she was seated in a chair that had been treated with linseed oil and some of it got on the fabric and smoldered while she napped and boom, because if I understand this correctly, when that oil takes, when that fire burns, it burns fast, furious, and without regard. Could there have been a chance that something like that could have taken place?
It's a very interesting suggestion you make, Dave. We're not going to categorically rule that out because, as we said, the evidence that we have in our file on the Rizzo case, which is about an inch thick, does not address that potential. Whether she had, spilt linseed oil on her chair the night before and then dropped a cigarette between her clothing and the chair fabric, and that's what ignited and fueled an intensely localized fire. Theoretically, you could argue that was a case to make. Had better investigation been done at that time, perhaps that would have been discovered and we would not be looking at Mrs. Reeser as a case of SHC. But Mrs. Reeser is not the only case that we've investigated over our decades of pursuing this very bizarre subject. And in some cases, we are pretty quite confident that linseed oil-soaked furniture is not the mechanism by which the body was incinerated to dry powder.
All right. Well, has science ever taken a look and considered spontaneous human combustion through history? Has it ever been something that they had entertained, or has it always been insane fringe science to them?
That's a very interesting question. Yeah. In the 17 and early 1800s, this was seriously considered within the medical profession. It was, if you pardon the phrase, a hotly debated subject. There were physicians that believed SHC was quite possible based on localized, wholly incinerated human beings in a fire scene that was otherwise dearth of the expected flame and heat damage you would expect to find within surrounding combustible materials. And then their colleagues would say, no, it's just impossible. There's just no way that this can happen, which is basically quoting what Dr. Mark Benecki says. There is just no way that spontaneous human combustion can happen. In about 1850, a German chemist named von Liebig, whose name isn't well known today, but in his day he was as famous as Albert Einstein is to today's generation. He looked at the phenomenon and decided he was going to conduct some experiments to see whether or not it was possible for a body to be incinerated to this extent by means that were then known. It was claimed at that time that all victims of SHC were alcoholic sots, and the alcohol that saturated their tissue was the fuel that provided for this unnaturally, totally combustible body once ignited externally. He conducted experiments and found that he could not get his burn subjects to incinerate to powder, and therefore he declared that spontaneous human combustion could not occur based on the methodology and the theory that he advanced. We've tried the same experiment ourselves just to make sure that he got it right, and we come up with the same results. We cannot take alcohol-saturated tissue, light it externally, and walk away and come back an hour later to find a pile of dry powder. The meat sample is 99% intact. Once the alcohol vaporizes off, the fuel is gone and the flame will self-extinguish. That unfortunately put the end to the mainstream scientific investigation into the concept of spontaneous human combustion, but it did not prevent people from burning up as thoroughly or even more completely than did Mary Hardy Reeser in 1951.
You know, one thing I'm curious about, okay, we look at some of the things that we can say it is not. Could it be in some of these cases, okay, you have somebody that's an alcoholic, so their body parts are saturated in the chemicals. Maybe they're a smoker, so they've also been ingesting formaldehydes and other combustible substances. And there was about 8 years ago, there was a big hubbub in the news that some baby powder formulas were being tested and found that the basic components of rocket fuel appeared in, and it was naturally kind of, what's the word I'm looking for here? Naturally existing chemicals that were found in these powders. So if we're ingesting a lifetime of all of these chemicals, couldn't it just be right that on occasion the right combustible moment will happen and that it is what sets us up? I mean, you've got it, you know, as a chemistry set, the chemicals individually are no danger until you start to mix and match them, right? And when you just get that right accidental mix, poof, you're gone. What are the thoughts on that for science?
It's certainly a fair argument to make, and we make the same argument when we address our research and present it to fire investigation classes at the college level, and it is this. If that happens, that is the only way to avoid having to contend with the concept of spontaneous human combustion, but what that leads to is a similar phenomenon that is not well known to this day. It's called preternatural combustibility, in which the body will burn with intense ferocity once ignited externally, once there's an external ignition source. If that is indeed the case, and we can rule out some cases of so-called SHC by that means, by preternatural combustibility, we are still left with a medical anomaly. What is the exact set of circumstances that affords certain human beings to be rarely and thoroughly completely ignitable?
Now, I'm going to throw out another strange question to you, and I appreciate your patience with me on this, but, you know, having done the show for 12 years and talked about all of the strange phenomena in the world around us, has there ever been any research looked at in these cases, Larry, of have there been UFO sightings in those areas? Have there been strange anomalies or other things that are going on that when we start to look at the bigger, you know, looking straight on and facing it, you're just seeing the 1 inch of the ruler. And as you step back, you see the entire length. Is there other weird phenomena that you can start to say, hey, look, this always goes on or is happening in this area when these type of cases occur?
You raise another very provocative aspect that we do address in our book, Ablaze. We devote a chapter to the what we believe is the relationship between UFOs, either technological or other types of unidentified aerial objects, and spontaneous human combustion. There is a very good case to be made for that. It's not a case that is comfortably made to fire scientists because, you know, we are dealing with one anomaly, which is SHC, and to bring in another controversial anomaly, UFOs, is very difficult for them to adjust to. But we do have a number of cases where we think the best explanation, although it's an external ignition source, comes from close encounters with unidentified flying objects, either in terms of natural phenomena such as fireballs and ball lightning, or if of the technological kind, a true unidentified flying object.
All right. Fascinating takes on all of this. We're up against a break. We'll come back and we'll continue this discussion with Larry Arnold, hear more of the cases that he's researched regarding spontaneous human combustion. Where does science stand at this point if they have already ruled out the fact that it can't just be a cigarette or a linseed oil? What is the response of how a body got that hot to fall into nothing but rubble and ashes in an environment which is nearly impossible and leave a small burn pattern? In most of these cases, it's a small burn circle around them, doesn't touch the ceiling or doesn't touch any of the other areas or combustible items in their vicinity. You would think just from something burning that hot, it would start to ignite other things around it. What's going on with this case? We'll find out more. We'll be back with more. Larry Arnold will be here as we continue to get through the smoke and haze of human combustion. Welcome back. Ablaze, the mysterious fires of spontaneous human combustion. That's our topic today. as we talk with our guest Larry Arnold about this. Larry, you told us some of the points that science looks at when they're telling you that this can't be possible. There's no way we can combust from inside, burn from the inside out, and be reduced to nothing but ash. But what are they saying about this? What exactly is it that could cause this kind of heat and do such minimal damage to the surrounding area? Do they have any theories besides a dropped cigarette or linseed oil?
Yeah, let us answer that this way. Scientists for the last 150-plus years since von Liebig did his experiments around 1850, they have taken the following approach to the subject of SHC. They either ignore it or they state that, you know, my mind is made up. They have a built-in bias. Dr. Lester Adelson, a medical examiner out in Ohio, when handed some of the photographs that we've amassed during our decades of researching this phenomenon, looked at the photographs and said, these photographs are hoaxes. And we asked him why. And he said, because bodies don't burn like this. In other words, they don't burn to powder like we described happened to Mrs. Reeser. They don't leave behind half of one leg and a pile of ash in below the basement, in the basement floor like Dr. Bentley left in our home state of Pennsylvania. We know for a fact that the photographs that we have amassed are not hoaxes. We know the provenance of the photographs. We know who took them. We know the circumstances under which these photographs are taken. The photographic evidence of these amazing cases are not hoaxed, so we can dismiss the bias. The approach that we found most often that scientists take is simply one based in fear or xenophobia. They are absolutely terrified of these fire scenes because what they've been trained in their decades of fire science study is refuted by the cases that we've documented. We'll never forget the case of a Philadelphia fire marshal after he spent several hours with a fire marshal, fire photographer in a neighboring community, viewing the dozen photographs that he had taken of the Helen Conway fire scene in 1964 in Upper Darby Township, in which the victim left behind, propped up against the chair in which she incinerated two lower legs and some body parts. The left hand, as memory calls, was burned right to the bone. You could see a charm bracelet dangling from her ulna, just below the wrist. The fire damage was intense to the body, but there was no damage directly above the chair in which she sat. The fire officials were absolutely mystified by this. When we put those photographs on the desk of the fire inspector in Philadelphia and said, you're the expert. You help us understand how this fire scene happened. How would you explain it? What would you do if you were called to this fire scene? He got very quiet and finally said, I'd go out, get drunk, and forget about it. At which point we were told to pack up our photographs, our evidence for the cases that we had in the city of brotherly love in Philadelphia, and we were escorted out of the building to the sidewalk. If you want to be that closed-minded about the subject, that's your prerogative. But don't say that the evidence doesn't exist. Don't lie about the evidence, which is what we found fire scientists so often doing in our decades of researching this phenomenon. For those who admit that the photographs do depict real fire scenes and are not hoaxes, what we will inevitably hear from them collectively, although there are a few exceptions, is that all these people burned up by a phenomenon called the wick theory, the human wick or the human candle. And what they posit is that the body will burn like an inverted candle once ignited externally by a dropped cigarette or match. The body's fat will start to burn, become the fuel for the fire that over a slow period of smoldering combustion lasting many, many hours, the body will slowly immolate to dry powder. As we said earlier, if it were that easy to do, crematorium operators would be, you know, buying cartons of cigarettes rather than investing $100,000 in very complicated and expensive crematorium equipment. We've done the experiment because we wanted to see, you know, were we barking up a tree fruitlessly in our research in its early days, and we tried that experiment. It does not work. We cannot replicate the candle effect to come anywhere close to duplicating the fire scene that Mrs. Reeser left behind or that Dr. Bentley left behind or that hundreds of other people left behind based on the photographs that we have collected and the historical evidence that we have amassed. This is a very rare, as we said at the very beginning of this interview, which makes it easy for mainstream scientists to dismiss the phenomenon. Just because it's rare doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
Right. I mean, you've got medical anomalies that happen, you know, one out of every 10 million, 15 million, 20 million people. It doesn't mean it didn't happen because it only happened so rare. Why do you think science wants to step away from saying that this is possible? I mean, in science today, you would think there's enough that we could say, hey, be careful what you put in your body, because you don't know what the side effects of chemicals are going to be. We already know that they're cancer-causing. They can cause diabetes, diseases, impotence, brain problems. You know that this already exists. Why not just come clear and say, hey, be careful. This is a possibility. It's very rare. It happens one every, you know, 20 years, something like this will happen. But the fact is, this is why you need to be careful. Why not just address it and the hubbub's over on it?
Yeah, we so wish that the mainstream science, both medically and in the fire forensics field, would come to that basic simple conclusion. Why they don't, again, we think falls back basically to those three things we listed earlier, primarily falling back on xenophobia. This simply raises a profound fear and shows that the experts who think they understand almost everything there is to know about fire, and the medical community that is a little less dogmatic in their understanding, as you say, they recognize that we're discovering new things all the time about biology and physiology and things that happen in the body. But the fire science community is really hard-nosed about things that fall outside what they've been trained to encounter, what they've been trained to understand, and what they think they can explain. And this whole field of spontaneous and preternatural combustibility really flies in the face of their collective expertise. And for many of them, it's just something that they don't want to contend with. There is, fortunately, though, a small segment of the fire service community that is open-minded, is curious. Chief Don Conkle, the former fire chief here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, is one of those open-minded individuals who's willing to consider the strangeness and the oddity of these fires and is interested in figuring out how they can happen, because in his view, they don't fit in with what he has been taught in his long fire service career to understand can be encountered at a fire scene. These fires, as we say, and we stress this repeatedly, are a rare event. However, if we studied them and we come to an understanding of what is the exact causative mechanism or mechanisms by which these human incinerations can occur, hopefully they would become even rarer, that we could find some means by which to predict when they are likely to occur and maybe take means to prevent somebody from suffering the flaming fate that befell Mrs. Reeser and Dr. Bentley and Helen Conway and hundreds of others.
How often does this occur? Are there one that takes place every year, unexplained phenomena like this, or is it much less?
It's less than that, at least to our knowledge. We also, as a caveat, say we are absolutely convinced there are more cases of this phenomenon than we have been able to identify, and our database right now is about 500 and counting.
And what is that time span?
That spans over a period of about 500 years.
Okay.
Although we do have cases that go back before into the Roman and Greek times, but the real classic cases that have some substantial documentation for them are basically from the 1500s and on. So divide that into the number of people that have been alive during those several centuries, and you can see how rare this phenomenon really is.
Has this ever taken place in front of eyewitnesses, where somebody just bursts in the flames?
Yes, it has. We have we've devoted a chapter in Ablaze to the eyewitness cases, and this really flies in the face of people like Dr. Benecki and others who want to invoke the wick theory. People have been observed by their spouses, by bystanders, by other family members, suddenly bursting into smoke or open flame combustion, not in contact with a dropped cigarette or carelessly tossed match. What is observed in these cases most often is that the color of the fire, and we put the word fire in air quotes because we're not convinced that these are oxidizing combustions, but perhaps more likely bioelectrical or bioplasmic or some kind of other chemical energy that is not an oxidizing fire. What most often is reported to be seen is a bright electric blue colored flame that engulfs the body. We've spoken to a senior fire brigade commander in London who was called to a scene involving a derelict hobo whose name is Robert Bailey, who was observed by Commander Stacy and his fire crew emanating from the victim's abdomen a bright electric blue flame jetting with force, he described it to us, and audibly with force from the victim's abdomen. They extinguished the flame with the contents of several fire extinguishers because Mr. Bailey was already dead when the fire was discovered emanating from his body. We wished, in the interest of science, that the fire crew would have simply left the event unfold to its natural conclusion to see if Mr. Bailey would eventually become a powdered body, as did Mrs. Reeser and Dr. Bentley. That did not happen, but we certainly have Mr. Stacey's eyewitness testimony that as a professional firefighter with decades career, this was the first fire scene of its nature that he had ever encountered, and in his professional viewpoint, it was a case of spontaneous human combustion because the fire, again, quote-unquote fire, was emanating from inside the body, burning outward.
All right. Could that be a form of microwave technology or electromagnetic attack, I guess you would say? I mean, we've heard about these type of weapons existing. Could it be something like that? And would that burn as hot?
In the case of Robert Bailey, probably not. Certainly not microwave to our ability to ascertain an external microwave source in a derelict apartment building in downtown London. However, that said, there are other cases that we do document in our book where it is known that microwave or electromagnetic radiation was present when the victim was burned spontaneously. So yes, microwaves is one source of, albeit external, it nonetheless is unseen, unsuspected, and unidentified prior to the burning of the human flesh.
Because wouldn't it be interesting if it is some type of internal, we know we're an electrical system, right?
Absolutely.
If that's what's taking place, if we're kind of grounding, that would be why movement hasn't taken place. The body's not flipping and flopping all over. We're almost being electrified from inside out. Are there natural emissions of things like microwave or electrostatic release that could cause something like this? Or is that, again, I'm not a scientist, or is that too far out of the realm of possibility?
It's surely out of the realm of possibility for some scientists. It is not out of the realm for our reality construct thinking. As you may know, there are a small select number of individuals who are pyrokinetic or exhibit static electrical type phenomena in their proximity, and these people, in a few cases that we do know of, have suffered spontaneous combustion to parts of their body. And this is another aspect of the phenomenon that is not well known. There are survivors of partial spontaneous human combustion.
Wow. All right, that's news. Let's talk about that in a minute, but I'm curious. You know, you talk about how some people have these distortions. We've had some listeners that have written in that told me, you know, I can't be around electronics. They'll shut down, they'll short, they'll have problems, things like that. And I've had some that have responded that said, you know, I found out after years of having this, I was dealing with a heavy metal poisoning. And once we were able to reverse that, the static, the issues that we've been involved with disturbances has gone away. Is that something you've heard about before?
We've not heard about heavy metal poisoning in conjunction with these electrostatic people. It's an interesting avenue for us to pursue further. Whether it relates directly to SHC, again, we can't say. There's so much that we would like to know about the phenomenon that oftentimes we could learn only by talking to the next of kin of the victims, and sadly, that has been something that has been almost impossible for us to achieve over our years of research. A recent case that we investigated in Oklahoma back in 2013, we traveled halfway across the country specifically to meet with the local authorities, the investigators who were baffled by this fire scene, and ask for our expertise, which we're happily willing to share with them. And we also hope to meet with the next of kin of the victim to learn, you know, about that person's medical history, his emotional background, all kinds of things that might give us insight into how this phenomenon occurs. Sadly, in that case, the next of kin were opposed to meeting with us and to helping us understand the history of the relative who died in a very localized, classic SHC-type fire scene.
Are there any common threads that run through these cases? Medical maladies, seizures, diabetes, tuberculosis, anything that you could say, you know what, each one does have these categories that they're kind of listed under.
The only commonality that we've been able to ascertain is that all the victims are human.
Screw it, Tim. We're both in trouble then.
Yep.
Yeah, anybody can get that. All right, so now talk to me about there are survivors of partial
survivors.
Spontaneous human combustion. How do they get put out?
The first one, and they almost always get put out autonomically. The body, for whatever reason, starts the phenomenon. It also kills the phenomenon in progress. The first gentleman that we had the privilege to meet, who we believe is a survivor of partial spontaneous human combustion, is Jack Angel. We did a program with him for a series called That's Incredible back in 1981 on ABC television. It is, to our knowledge, the only filmed interview that Jack ever gave. His story very succinctly is that he was a traveling salesman. He uses motorhome as a traveling showroom. He had an appointment with a client on a Tuesday morning in Savannah, Georgia. He parked the motorhome Monday night at a Ramada Inn parking lot in Savannah, expecting to meet with his client the following morning. He went to sleep on the bedding in the motorhome. He missed his appointment. He awakened several days later to find that his right forearm had been burned black, charred to the bone, as he described it to us. He also had burned injuries on his back, in his groin, on the nape of his neck. And yet the sheeting on which he was sleeping did not singe. The pajamas that he wore did not burn. He exited the motorhome in full consciousness, aware of his injuries, but perplexed as to how they had happened. Lost consciousness, regained consciousness in the Savannah General Memorial Hospital, finding himself surrounded by a team of medical practitioners, all of whom were amazed by the burn injury that was presented to them. We have Jack's medical records. The attending physicians diagnosed the burns as electrical in nature and, quote-unquote, internal in origin. Given that medical diagnosis, we can but conclude that they assessed that Jack burned from the inside out, burns internal in origin. The motorhome was eventually ripped down to the chassis by a team of liability attorneys in the Atlanta area. They had filed a multi-million-dollar lawsuit against the manufacturer of the motorhome, thinking that a water leak or an electrical malfunction had caused the burns. That was all ruled out. They looked at, you know, lightning as an external cause. That was ruled out. They could find nothing in or around the motorhome that could be attributed to Jack's burn injuries other than what the physician said was that he burned from the inside out, which by definition we believe is spontaneous human combustion. And that was certainly Mr. Angel's conclusion as well. We have since interviewed dozens of other survivors of partial SHC, none of whom have experienced as severe a burn injury as did Jack Angel. In fact, his right forearm was burned so badly he elected to have it amputated at the elbow. Other survivors report blistering of the body spontaneously, or the body will suddenly erupt in a plume, a gush of smoke, often described as grayish white in color, sometimes bluish white. This has been witnessed by bystanders. In the case of Peter Jones in 1980, his wife was sitting next to him in bed when his body became engulfed in a billowing cloud of smoke that seemed to erupt from his lower abdominal area. She screamed that he was on fire. She started patting him all over the body to put out the fire, so-called. Mm-hmm. The smoking spontaneously stopped. Second time that day when Peter Jones was alone in his car, smoking again billowed from his body, this time from the upper shoulders and arms. In neither instance did he experience any pain or discomfort, and certainly there was no explanation as to why this happened to him.
These cases, I mean, with the remnants, is there no way to do a DNA scraping or anything of what's left over to, you know, on them, the physical aspect, not what's burned to the ground, but to find out what's going on? Or do none of them have an interest in knowing why that happened to them?
Yeah, that's a question that we have posed again and again, and we also get frustrating results to posing that question. The death certificates of a number of the victims, Dr. Bentley, for example, in Pennsylvania in 1966, a similar case happened in upstate New York to a retired firefighter, George Mott, in 1986. And we had the death certificates for both individuals. Both death certificates as a legal document state that the victims died by asphyxiation. The problem is, to determine medically asphyxiation as cause of death, you need a trachea, esophagus, or lungs. In neither case were those organs left intact. They were ashen. So medically, you cannot deduce asphyxiation as cause of death. The one case that we have where a toxicological workup was attempted is the case that happened in Bolingbrook, Illinois in 1979, Thanksgiving weekend. The victim was Beatrice Oskey. There was enough of her body left intact in the chair in which she incinerated that a tox could be done. No accelerants were found, nor was any drop of blood found in the limbs that she left behind. Beyond that, there was nothing useful that was revealed in the toxicological workup that would help lead to an understanding of why she burned so completely and thoroughly.
Let's hear about a few of the other cases just so people realize. What is one of the most recent cases that you were able to track down?
The most recent case we'd stick our research on happened in 2013, February, in eastern Oklahoma, in Sequoia County. The victim's name is Danny Van Zandt. This is the case that we flew halfway across the country to meet with the county sheriff and the fire departments involved. Sheriff Lockhart declared that this might be a case of spontaneous human combustion. He qualified it, but he was at least open to the concept and the reality of this being a potential worthy of consideration as a law enforcement official. A conclusion for which he, not surprisingly, took a lot of grief and heat and rebuke on the internet, but what those who reviled his assessment did not know about Sheriff Lockhart was, before he was elected sheriff in Sequoia County, he had spent 20 years as an arson investigator. He was familiar with fires. He knew what to expect at a fire scene, and what happened at the Danny Van Zandt fire scene was something quite atypical to his experience. He was willing, and bless his heart, he was willing to be open-minded enough to consider SHC as a possibility. Certainly the fire scene fit the concept of SHC. In this case, Mr. Van Zandt left behind his head, full-sized, and upper shoulders. Below the shoulder blades, there is very little left intact other than his heart, but no lungs, no pancreas, no liver, no stomach. All internal organs other than the heart had been ashened. He left behind 1 foot on the floor of the kitchen through which the rest of the body burned, and in the crawl space below the kitchen floor was part of a leg, and the other tennis shoe still on the foot of that leg. No heat or flame damage directly to the ceiling above the point of combustion. Surrounding appliances, a stove, a refrigerator, show no evidence of blistering or charring. And if memory serves, there's some slight disagreement on this, but in general, the first responders said there was no odor of burned flesh at the fire scene.
This fascinates me. Tim, you think of all the stuff you've got going on in your life. At least this isn't happening.
Well, I haven't started to combust, but Larry, I got to know this. Has there been any case in your records, or have you heard of a case where someone has started to combust, been put out, and then later combusts and either dies or has had multiple combust cases and continues to survive?
Peter Jones is the case that comes to mind of recurring SHC. As we said, twice in one day, his body self-smoked. That was the extent of his SHC. He told us there's a third period in his life in which he thought perhaps he experienced a spontaneous human combustion type event, but he wasn't real clear. The body, part of his body in that case, became suddenly, you know, bright red, as would be expected in a first degree burn. But neither he or we, neither he nor ourselves, are willing to go with that third case on the record. It's subjective. But at least twice it's happened to Peter Jones. He and his wife will vow to that. There is a case from the 1700s, if memory serves, where the victim was encountered in flame. A bystander expecting, you know, that throwing water on the fire would put the fire out. The water application exacerbated the quote unquote flame that was engulfing the victim. But eventually the fire did go out, and he, according to the historical accounts, suffered severe agony for several days before finally succumbing to his, you know, burn injuries or other injuries attendant to the episode.
How did Peter Jones put his fires out, or what was starting to become a fire?
Gatorade, Tim. Gatorade. Nestea.
his wife Barbara started patting him down, as one would, you know, logically and spontaneously start to do, and the smoking stopped. Whether the padding had anything to do with it, we probably think not. The second time, he was alone in his automobile at a railroad grade crossing when smoke exuded from his upper arms and under the sleeves of his shirt. Peter's one of these amazing gentlemen who can remain quite calm under fire, if you will. He told us that he rolled down the window of his car to vent the smoke. The smoke went out, the fire stopped, or the smoking stopped, and that was the end of the episode, the second episode.
Okay, now as an engineer, for a second here, Larry, think about this. If you're trying to pat down a fire, first of all, you're smothering it. If it's internal, how are you smothering something that's inside your body?
You're not.
Exactly.
Well, that's why he said you can't. He doesn't know if that helped at all.
It couldn't have helped. But then secondly, if it's something where, and obviously if you're going to strike a match, you're doing something physical to strike it, you would think if you're patting something to put it out, you might be physically striking something like a match against a rock to get it to combust even more. Wouldn't you think that might accelerate more than put it out?
In hindsight, without facing the situation in real time, yes, that makes perfect sense. But when you're presented with something that is so unexpected, quite a surprise that you never thought could be happening to your spouse, you know, your autonomic response is it's a fire. Let's try to get rid of the oxygen that is fueling the fire. So by patting it, she was probably thinking that she could, you know, smother or remove the source of oxygen and help save the life of her husband. In hindsight, what you say makes perfect sense, but
you know, the other thing to consider,
she didn't have hindsight at the time.
The other thing to consider is because it sounds almost like an electrical fire in some cases, mm-hmm. or an electromagnetic mm-hmm. fire, maybe by simply adding her dynamic to the mix, by touching him, she grounded him to stop the fire, to stop the connection. Her chemical reaction might have been enough to kind of abate what was beginning to happen.
That's a very savvy suggestion. Could well be.
I'm guessing the other thing, too, and I guess there's no way to find this out because it hasn't been documented, and I guess nobody's been there to try it, but what are the odds that a fire extinguisher could potentially put somebody out who's going through SHC?
Well, if it's a chemical fire that the fire extinguisher is rated to extinguish, would probably work. As we said with the case of Robert Bailey in London, the first responders dumped the contents of several fire extinguishers into Mr. Bailey's gut. The fire, again, euphemistically calling it a fire because we're not convinced that this is an oxidizing combustion, as Dave suggests, it's more likely an electrical or biochemical process that's happening. Whatever the fire extinguishers put out that quote-unquote fire, whether by removing the source of oxygen or by, you know, shorting out the electrical process that was unfolding, we can't say.
Because most, and the reason why I bring it up again is because most fire extinguishers these days are a powder. They're not the old fashioned foam or whatever it was we put in there 20, 30 years ago. They tend to be more of just a powder. Correct. Per se. Is that change in chemical form going to help or harm SHC these
days? That's got to be hard to know because we don't know what's causing the combustion to begin with.
Right. Yeah. I know it's all theoretical and speculation, but.
I'm just going to pack you in salt and carry you around, Tim.
All right. Yeah. Sounds like a plan to me.
Yeah. Just to be safe. It's for science, Tim. I know our time's running away from us here. I just want to hear some of the other cases. I mean, have we had anybody like a Michio Kaku or any other major known scientist willing to come forward to say, hey, there might be something here?
We were not aware at this moment of any scientist of Michio's stature who has come forward and said, yep, there's something really here. Let's delve deeper into it. And Larry's got himself some really solid research that we need to give credence to and investigate further. What we do find, however, is the opposite side of that. We have, as not only with Mark Benecki, who we quoted earlier, saying that SHC is impossible because there's no known case in which internal organs are burned more severely than external body parts, absolutely categorically false. We also have another fire forensics expert in this country on a par with Dr. Mark Benecki, who has actually falsified experiments in his attempt to invoke and prove the Wick theory can explain all these cases that Larry Arnold in history calls spontaneous human combustion. We're not going to name him for this broadcast, but if you've seen some of the programs we've done for Discovery and A&E and TLC, you probably know to whom we refer. If you have to lie about the results of your experimentation, if you design experiments that are false to begin with, that are fraudulent, what's the value of your scientific training and what's the value of your argument against the research that we've compiled? It has no value. If you have to lie about your experimentation and its results, your theory isn't going to have any merit whatsoever. Why would one risk one's reputation to deny a phenomenon? And the only way to deny it is to lie about it.
Has there ever been this phenomena running through a family, more than one family member having had it occur?
Not that we can recall in our database at this time. Fortunately not. We don't see a hereditary factor in the phenomenon. It's truly spontaneous, not only by name, but by manifestation.
All right. Coming into the end of this, I mean, what is your hope by continuing this research? What do you think? I mean, many years have gone by. They said 1600s are when some of these cases started to happen, mm-hmm. perhaps even sooner, and science is still turning a blind eye to it. Do you see that there will be acceptance of this at some point in the near future, or is this always going to remain too fringe of an element and too unexplainable to get into?
Yes, at some time there's going to be a formal acceptance of this phenomenon. We're absolutely convinced of that. The evidence that we've compiled over 40 years will stand up, we believe, to the strongest scientific scrutiny. It just needs to be looked at by scientists who are willing to do so with an open mind and without bias. When that happens remains to be seen, of course. There just may be several cases that happen in close concurrence that cannot be ignored and get a lot of publicity. Or it happens to someone who is very famous in a very public arena, you know. If a president standing before a lectern and a bank of television cameras suddenly bursts into bright blue flame and becomes pulverized, yeah, I think at that point it's going to be really damn hard to deny spontaneous human combustion.
Tim, I think it's time you offer yourself up just for science sake.
No, it's all right.
Come on, man.
No.
You always wanted to make a name for yourself. Let's do this.
It's not going to do it that way. Not going to happen.
He's a quitter. I'm sorry. I just can't get him to come along with us on this, Larry.
I got enough issues.
The idea that this continues today and that it's gone on for 500, 600, 700, 800 years and has been witnessed, has left crazy evidence that there is something going on. You know, in mainstream media, you'd think that they would jump on these stories. Why are they not taking it and really kind of fanning, pardon the upon fanning the flames of this and keeping it out
right,
in front of people.
Yeah.
They love weird
stories. Perhaps in part because until fairly recently, this was a subject that appeared in print media, largely in the tabloid press, and alongside finding B-25 bombers on the surface of the moon and stuff like that. So it was easy for the mainstream media to just kind of write it off as silly stuff. Not the case, but again, we've been interviewed by mainstream newspapers. The Toronto Star comes to mind, and so on, papers of that caliber. So we get nice coverage, and yet it doesn't seem to go anywhere. When we were down at the National Fire Academy in Emmitsburg several years ago, wrapping up our research part of the publication of Ablaze, we met with the three senior fire instructors on duty that day. When we tried to present our evidence to the first gentleman, he kind of took a passing interest and said, yeah, I've heard about this, but no thanks. I really don't want to know about it. The second one that we encountered in a hallway, when we tried to hand him a couple photographs, he actually spun on his heels and ran down the hallway from us, and the last thing we heard from him was, I don't want to know about this. That episode happened to occur in the presence of the third instructor who was walking the other direction, and he said, let me look at those photographs. Bring them into my office, sit down and tell me everything you know, because we don't have a clue. We need, science needs, mankind needs the approach of that third fire instructor at the National Fire Academy that day to look at the evidence for spontaneous human combustion, study it, try to figure it out, not only as a matter of scientific curiosity and understanding of new facts and situations, but to prevent lives from being lost from this process in the future.
Yeah, this is something that should be watched and reported on more often, and hopefully there is an answer for this, because it is a frightening aspect of our world, whether you want to accept it or not. It's like I said, I think it's interesting that this kind of fits in the realm of very rare, unique diseases, even like the Elephant Man, right? The issues that he had, it's rare, it doesn't happen often, but it's undeniable at this point. I mean, science, they have no explanation. They can tell you that it shouldn't be able to do this, but then they can't tell you why it did do that. And that to me is a breakdown in research.
And we wholly concur with that assessment. Absolutely, you're spot on. We're looking forward to that changing at some time, hopefully very soon, which is why we enjoy doing programs such as yours so much, because not only does it enable us to get our research out to a open-minded audience, but in turn, hopefully some of your listeners might have had either personal experiences or know of cases that fit the classic definition of SHC, or have some theories, ideas to suggest to us. We're eager always to hear from people with anything credible, sane, positive, constructive to offer to us.
Well, how can people reach out to you if they believe that they have a story that fits, or know of somebody that they believe this has happened to?
Sure. One easy way we would think would be to, follow up the posting that you would make on Darkness Radio and how to get in contact with us. Beyond that, the easiest way is to go to our website, Parascience, parascience.com. Drill down until you see the email address, parascience2.gmail@gmail or shchappens@gmail, and contact us that way with ideas, case leads, suggestions, ideas. Even if you want to give us a credible refutation, that's fine. We'll see where we go, but we're eager to learn more about the phenomenon by whatever source and means we can find credible information. The mystery truly remains at this point.
It does. Fascinating stuff. Larry, thank you so much for coming on and spending some time with us this evening to shed some light on this very bizarre situation.
You are most welcome. We appreciate and welcome the opportunity, Dave and Tim. Best to you and blessings to all your listeners.
Thank you very much. And that's about it for this evening, folks. Again, we want to thank TrueCar, our sponsors. When you're ready to buy a new or previously owned, check out TrueCar. And when you're ready to start taking your books on the road with you, use Audible. And for listeners of our podcast, Audible's offering a free audiobook download and a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. It's a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/ /darkness with over 180,000 titles to choose from for all of your devices. So check that out. Tim, you're going to be at IWI Wrestling this weekend. How can people come see you?
Well, the easiest way, details at moundstheater.org. It is 6:45 is when doors open. 7:30 is when the event starts. It is Night of the Luchas at Mounds Theater. We're celebrating Cinco de Mayo weekend by having an entire card of Lucha Libre wrestling.
It's exciting. It's fun. It's family friendly. And there's booze. So there go on out and have a little bit of fun. Tomorrow we'll be back. Nicholas Wood is our guest. The Sorrel Weed House of Savannah, Georgia. We'll talk about the tragic history and haunting of that location. And if you missed out on True Crime Tuesday yesterday, you can go subscribe right now. You can get our first two episodes. They're already up. Yesterday's episode where we talked again with Alan Warren about a terrifying story, Bloodthirst, the true story of Wayne Bodden, the vampire serial killer. You can also hear our first episode from last week. And all you have to do is subscribe. $5 a month gets you four brand new 90 to 120 minute episodes of True Crime Entertainment. Plus you get Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals every week delivered to you. Go check out darknessradio.com. Click on the True Crime Tuesday tab, the button there, and it'll take you through to sign up. It's very inexpensive, only $1.25 per episode for up to 2 hours of entertainment every week. You love the show. Show us the love back. Sign up for it now. That's it for tonight. Be safe, be kind, love one another, and... Tim, do I smell you smoking over there? Oh,
no.
My God. All right, we'll be back tomorrow. God forbid Tim's smoldering by then, but otherwise we'll be back here on Beyond the Darkness.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play and win from the comfort of your own home with hundreds of slot games and all of the table games you love with real cash prizes. Right now, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 for new users. It's all at SpinQuest.com. That's SPINQUEST.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
It's Cybersecurity Awareness Month. LifeLock is here with tips to help protect your identity. Use strong passwords, set up multi-factor authentication, report scams, and update your software. And for comprehensive identity protection, LifeLock is your best choice. LifeLock alerts you to suspicious uses of your personal information and fixes identity theft, guaranteed, or your money back. Start your protection today with a 30-day free trial at LifeLock.com. Use promo code NEWS. Terms apply.